Welcome to The Pestle, reviewing and breaking down movies to look for insights into the movie-making process. Hosted by the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where every meal is served with ketchup. Let's dim the lights and start the show.
Welcome, everybody, to The Pestle. Today's show is brought to you by Hill Valley Bluebird Motel. Get a great rate for your trip to Hill Valley at Bluebird Motel. Welcome, everyone, to The Pestle. I am Wes.
And I am Todd.
And we like to discuss films from the standpoint of people who, you know, work in production on both sides of the line of the camera, sometimes in front, sometimes behind. Todd's been a full-time producer for a while now, and he's just climbing that ladder. And is also like doing music for a very long time. I've been writing for a very long time and directing for a little over 10 years now. And we like to look at a film from that standpoint of what can we learn from it, as well as, is it good? Like, good cinema, bad cinema. It's often about how you relate to it. It's hard to watch something that is so far outside of your wheelhouse and really enjoy it. And so sometimes it's a bit like food, and that, you know, enjoying a really high-end meal probably takes a little practice, which is a funny thing to say about something you've been doing for every day of your life. And yet your palate does need to adjust to certain new tastes. And that's always a bit of a process. And so we covered Fury. I don't remember how long ago. Time with this show is a bit of a flat circle. So somewhat recently, but in that episode, because it's about World War II, and you know, you have the fight in Germany, and so I was just curious, and I put out a call to our German listeners to let us know, like, what's it like as a German, you know, watching World War II stuff that America pumps out like it's the cure for cancer. And so, because I didn't know, I was like, what's that experience like? And we had, you know, a German listener reach out. They asked to not be named or quoted, but the gist of it was, doesn't bother them. Like, they think it really has a lot to do with empathy. And just if you have that level of empathy, then you can watch and engage with that stuff without feeling, I don't know, anything personal about it. They said that effectively they watch it the same as you and I. Like, there's no real difference. Which when they started talking about the reasoning and their logic and how they feel, and that they don't want to speak for everyone, but their sense is that's the general vibe. It just suddenly made, I mean, it was so obvious whenever you start, you know, putting it like that, because we do it all the time, right? If we're Americans, we have a really sordid past in our country. Oh, yeah. With, you know, a lot of things, but racism has never been shied away as a topic, you know, for quite some time. And we watch those films. Like, I don't feel attacked when I watch a movie about slavery or, you know, civil rights in Jim Crow, what have you. Like, that, I don't feel any connection to that stuff at all, even though I'm sure I've got family members, you know, in the past who have certainly partaken to some degree or another. I don't think I have any, like, slave owners in my family lineage. But I definitely think, you know, there's probably racism that runs through my bloodline. And I don't feel any personal identification with that. These are just two separate worlds. That's not the world I grew up in or was born into. And so there's an emotional divide that allows me to watch those films without feeling anything other than what you're supposed to be feeling while watching those stories. And so it just suddenly made sense. And I think that's one of the really amazing aspects of art and movies, music too, of course. But films, you can just go into a story and suddenly you're building empathy. You're building a worldview that didn't exist before being able to watch and entertain these ideas without feeling personal about them beforehand or feeling like they're aimed at you. And that is if you're doing it well. Now, some films don't do that very well because they wear all that stuff on their sleeve, and it's about, you know, this performative, you know, not vigil, but like a performative aesthetic of we're demonstrating how much better we are than XYZ. Like, it's not offensive in the sense of I feel attacked. It's offensive in the sense of this is a boring story, because you need to complicate it a little bit more. That doesn't make it so easy to find. You need to be finding humanity through everyone on screen, because it's pretty rare you run into someone in real life that doesn't have some humanity, doesn't have some personal perspective. And generally, that's what I really love about cinema, is it allows you to do that, to entertain ideas that aren't yours, but that allow you to expand your thinking and engage with content that you otherwise wouldn't have any personal experience with. You're gaining sympathy and empathy for people all over the world, even in your own culture, even in your own city, just because there's so much universal aspects to filmmaking and storytelling. Yeah, in so many ways. I don't know. Is that your sense as well about just what film can do for people?
Yeah, in a way, seeing stuff that's hard to watch can be healing. I feel like, you know, it's yeah. I'm not of the mind that we should dwell on things, but I am of the mind that some things shouldn't be forgotten, and especially in an era where, you know, like right now, you know, we don't own slaves, you know, we don't, like, the Holocaust is not happening, you know, right now. However, I think it's important to kind of understand what was a sliver of what people were feeling back then from either side, right? So when you see a movie about slavery and the terrible experiences that these people went through, like, it's not so much to make you feel bad. It's just to say, this here is a perspective of something. And I think that's important. I think it's vital. I think it's a part of storytelling that is its own thing, because you have fiction, you have nonfiction, you have things that are related to true facts but are embellished. That might be why Tarantino gets a lot of heat, though, because he takes that whole, hey, remember this, and he takes it to a whole nother level where I think people just feel uncomfortable, you know, with it. And I think that's his goal in a lot of ways, is like you should feel uncomfortable. I'm going to put you in this place where you feel uncomfortable in your skin, and then you can leave and do with it what you will, you know? And what other medium can do that, really?
That's so true. And you're right. Just because there's not a Holocaust in Germany happening right now doesn't mean there isn't something that you can learn from that. And the more honestly you depict some of these characters, whether it's whatever, slavery or, you know, SS, you know, it's important to give them that sense of humanity, or else the bigger lesson's going to be lost about how that's within all of us. All those things are within all of us. And if you don't recognize that, if you don't say, these are things I am not, like, incapable of doing, then you can then fall victim to it. It's so much easier to just, you know, point your finger and say, there's evil over there, without being able to say, here's my vulnerability, here's how I could get pulled in, because this person, who's a very reasonable, loving person, they have a family, they have kids that they love, they don't let their best friend get hurt, you know, not on their watch. And yet they're over here in another scene being a racist, or being, you know, a slave owner or whatever. Like, you need to see those human aspects just to realize these are things that we're all capable of. And the more I can recognize that, the less I feel able to not recognize those things whenever they happen, or they're creeping on me. If I can recognize, you know, how good people can go wrong, then I can recognize how I could also go wrong, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Today we are covering The Bourne Identity. So if you haven't seen this film from 2002, please pause this episode, go watch it, because we're going to spoil a bunch of stuff.
We'll look at some of the cinematography, camera work, lighting, as well as some of the sound design and editing and other such stuff and things and stuff.
And a quick synopsis of the film. A man is picked up by a fishing boat, bullet-riddled and suffering from amnesia, before racing to elude assassins and attempting to regain his memory. It's directed by Doug Liman. Screenplay by Tony Gilroy and William Blake Heron. It's based on the novel by Robert Ludlum. It's cinematography by Oliver Wood, featuring Matt Damon as Jason Bourne, Franca Potente as Marie, Chris Cooper as Conklin, Brian Cox as Ward Abbott, Adewale Akinoje Agbaje as Wambosi. That's the best I can do. Julia Stiles as Nicolette/Nikki.
way better than what I would have done. My God. Ooh. Well done.
Nice.
I'm not making this up. These are real.
Okay.
Who has a safety deposit box full of money and 6 passports and a gun? Who has a bank account number in their hip? I come in here, and the first thing I'm doing is I'm catching the sight lines and looking for an exit.
I see the exit sign, too. I'm not worried. I mean, you were shot. People do all kinds of weird and amazing stuff when they're scared.
I can tell you the license plate numbers of all 6 cars outside. I can tell you that our waitress is left-handed and the guy sitting up at the counter weighs 215 pounds and knows how to handle himself. I know the best place to look for a gun is the cab of the gray truck outside. And at this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking. Now, why would I know that? How can I know that and not know who I am?
Man, so when this came out, big deal. And I don't remember exactly why, other than, some of the action was interesting. But my impression is we were inundated with spy thrillers that were very big, like Mission Impossible kind of stuff. And it had been a while since we'd had like a French Connection, kind of more dirtier on the ground. And it, not everything is super, super over the top big. And so that was my impression. But it's been 22 years since The Bourne Identity was birthed, and I'm wondering how it's done over the last 20 years. Is it still working for you?
For me, it is. For me, it's a great, movie. And one of the reasons why I think it works for me is because it was really one of the first for me that I could identify with. You know, I can't remember if Mission Impossible was before or after it, the first one.
Oh, before, way before.
Way before, right? Yeah, okay. But the thing with Mission Impossible is I felt like, well, forget Mission Impossible, but the thing with this movie is I feel like I'm with him the whole time. There's a reason why he goes to Switzerland for the bank. There's a reason why he goes to Paris, because he finds out he lives in Paris because he went to the bank. There's a reason why he goes to, you know, wherever he is, we have a reason why we're there, and we go on this journey with him, as opposed to just, oh, I just found this out. We got to go to Paris. And then we're in Paris and we're in the place we need to be in a giant city, but he just happens to know where he needs to be. No, like I cannot follow that. There's no way that I could know to be in that position, me as a viewer, because what am I doing? The entire time watching this movie, I'm putting myself in Jason Bourne's shoes. I am the hero. I am the guy with amnesia that knows that guy at the counter weighs 215 pounds and can handle himself, which I thought was a really cool way to say that.
That is a really cool way.
That's a cool line. So I'm putting myself in this badass position. I want to know why I'm in Paris and why I'm going to where I'm going and how I got there. And I felt like this movie took me with it the whole time. There was a reason why, you know, I didn't go to a nice hotel. I went to a dive hotel. There's a reason why we dyed her hair. There's a reason why I need to tell her, get out of the car, because you're going to slow me down. You know, last chance. There's a reason for all of these things, why he's going to the train station. You know, I'm there with him and I know why, and I would have done the same thing. Or maybe not the same. I would have.
Right.
I couldn't have beat up those people. But the point is like, I'm going to these places because there's a reason that's led me there and it makes sense. And I felt like this movie, more than others in its category, did that so well. It didn't leave me behind. It kept me with them. And I think it does justice to the fact that he has amnesia because of that. Like, you know, if you think of Mission Impossible, he doesn't have amnesia necessarily. So he can go and do whatever. He's supposed to be ethereal, like above us, and can do all these things that we can't. So we're aspiring to be Ethan Hunt. But with Jason Bourne, We are Jason Bourne. We know what he knows. We don't know what he doesn't know. He doesn't know what he doesn't know, and we don't know what that is. Neither does he. That makes sense, and I don't know how that makes sense. But because of that, we're learning together. And because we're learning together, the director doesn't leave us behind. He makes sure to give us a reason as a viewer why we're there, because that gives Jason a reason why he's there. And that, for the whole movie, kept me with him, you know? I'll stop there and we can talk about it more or whatever. But yeah, I loved it.
That's interesting. So I was kind of split. Like, I was a bit 50-50 on this experience. I think acting, really good. Watching Matt Damon suddenly know things and be confused by it in the process of doing it, really hard stuff. Like, he is killing it in this movie. And I really enjoyed that. I mean, I enjoyed him on screen. And I thought him and Franca Potente are fantastic together. And I think the pacing, I thought, was made a lot of sense. This is a 2-hour film, and you can't speed that up. You can't speed up any of this, or else it's going to get really, really corny really, really fast. You know, you need these moments of him trying to figure something out, or just being a little lost. And that just takes time. There's no substitute for that. You really just need time on screen for some of those things to really develop. The things that I wasn't as big fan of is all the stuff happening at the CIA headquarters. That felt a little cliche and derivative and just like bit of overacting there. And it's funny for me to look at whatever Brian Cox and Chris Cooper, who are some of the greatest actors ever, and I've never not liked seeing them on screen, but watching, you know, Chris Cooper have to breathe life into some of those lines and to, you know, fill up scenes just was brutal. It was really, really hard.
I could see that. Yeah,
right. Like, and then
I did have those moments.
There were those moments, and it probably didn't help having these like 75-pound computer monitors filling up the screen.
Well, it's 2002, you know?
I know.
Like, forgive him a little bit. And then at one point he says, you know, after they assassinate, what's his name?
Oh, Wambosi.
No, Conklin, I guess. After Chris Cooper
gets
killed.
Oh, at the very end. Yeah.
The very end. And then Brian Cox says, shut it down. They don't ever shut it down. It's 24 hours a day. They don't turn off the computers and now it's over, you know. I don't even think in 2002 they did that, you know. But right. But I, when he said that, that was a moment where I was like, oh, come on, man. You're not going to shut it down. Whatever. I know he probably meant treadstone, but
yeah.
No.
Yeah,
anyway.
No. And then, so that was a part of it. You know who I really liked in here, though, that she didn't have a lot of screen time, but Julia Stiles I thought was fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it was nice because in this era, she was always playing the cute girl and very lovable. And here, I mean, she's still going to be cute because that's, you know, her. But it never, it felt very buttoned up, and her character made sense to me of how she got there. She's a, you know, the low person on the totem pole. She's doing all this grunt work, but it's not dumb work. Like, you need some intelligence. And she's kind of discarded by Conklin at one point, right? Like, I could send Nikki to do that. And I mean, so I like how she's treated in the film, and yet, you know, she carries an air of, I'm not nobody, I'm paying my dues, and I will rise through the ranks. And for how little screen time and character development they give her, like, I feel like she develops a lot. She's doing a lot within that tiny bit of margin. And it's really, really impressive, her performance there. The other thing that I didn't like, though, well, it was iffy. It was here and there. Was some of the sound design was not great. Like that first, the most famous fight sequence in here, right, is the window. The guy comes bursting through the window, and you're hearing these like very 80s kind of.
Oh, yeah.
And it, it sounded like the Jones from Police Academy was in had a mic.
Bang. Pow.
It was just so clunky.
I couldn't agree more, man.
This, I think, you know, half the film could probably do with a redesign on the sound, just to make it feel like that guy gets his arm crunched back and it's just like, it's like, no, come on. I need some bones, some snapping. Like, I should be wincing way more, at that sound effect. So there was a lot of cheese in some of the sound design. Not all of it, because They do some really smart sound design for sure in like the big chase sequence. Whenever he does tell her like, this is your last chance, and then he gets going. That whole chase sequence is like screeching tires and brakes and gas revving the engine, sirens. Like, it adds a huge element of action to, if you remove that stuff, if you watch that whole sequence on mute, you can tell none of those sounds are happening, like very little of it anyway. And it suddenly makes that whole sequence very dull. And you're like, no, let's, because the editing isn't always super fast there. Like, they really let you sit for, you know, 2 seconds watching, which is not a lot in an action sequence. 2 seconds a cut is slow for an action sequence. And they do. They'll let, you know, hey, we're going to watch this car jump the curb and ride up the sidewalk for, you know, a couple beats. And then we're going to cut around and, yeah, we'll jump here and there. But the sound design really carried that sequence a great deal. And just some really nice wide shots mixed in with really nice close shots. I mean, it's edited really, really nicely, but you know, a lot of the editing gets into this jumpy style, where within a scene, you're just kind of cutting away to cut away again. And I think part of it's necessity. And if you're going to be generous, which I try to be, I think it also kind of plays into the memory fragmenting concept of Bourne trying to remember things. And so the more you can jump around, I think it plays into that, though I wouldn't say that was super intentional. But if I'm being generous, that's the way I would look at it. But it does give you a sense of energy, you know, and a sense of danger whenever you don't know necessarily where the next cut's going to take you. And so it's a good mix, though, editing wise, of they'll do that for a sequence, like we're in CIA, and to give it some life, they're just jumping around all over the place. But then whenever Jason is running around the city, they'll do some really nice slow shots walking them down the street. And what's he looking at? Oh, he's seeing that. And they take their time. So it's a healthy mix, so you don't get exhausted like they do in the sequels. The sequels are borderline unwatchable. And it's crazy to think they said, oh, you know what we kind of did, you know, on the first one? Let's hit a few lines of coke and just really ramp it up.
let's just take a bowling ball and put it on the edit key and let it run.
It's crazy. Like, I think I've only 3 times in a movie theater gotten nauseous from the style. I think it's the sequel, The Ultimatum. I think is that
the one where with the towel and the book?
Yeah. Yeah,
in the shower, with yes. that fight scene. I've never seen so much editing in my life.
Crazy, and that whole movie, I had to look away a few times just because I was starting to get nauseous. And the other two were like Cloverfield, which is just a bunch of handheld, and then I can't really explain this one, but the Lars movie. Oh my God, it's the
Lars and the Real Girl?
No. Lars von Trier, sorry. although that's a nice pull, by the way. Ron Gosling. Well done. Yeah. the one with the moon or the planet crashing into the earth. And Melancholia. But otherwise, like, this movie does it so well. Bourne Identity knows when to use those moments because you never really lose track of anything.
Yeah.
They do it. It adds energy and you also get a sense of the geography of the room. So they do a great job of quick cutting without losing the audience. And this was just the way to do it.
Dude. Well, that scene you talked about with the cheesy punchy sounds is a great fight scene. That's why I didn't call it out because. Mm-hmm. I love that scene. That's yes. The first, really one of the first times, not the first time, because the first time is when he's in the park and he beats up the cops. But this is the first time he's really challenged that I remember, I think. Mm-hmm. And we're in a big room. We're not in a tight space. We're in a big room. You know, the guy comes at him. He does a move, and we see the results from that attack. And then they back up again, and then they go at it again and see the results. It's very fulfilling in a way, you know, where he tries to get a hit in and we see what Jason does. And we're learning with Jason. I think Jason's probably like, how the hell can I do this? But he's doing it. But we take our time and it's like a breathable space. It's a breathable edit. It's fantastic. Anyway, yeah.
Agreed.
Great point.
Completely agree. Yeah, so I was iffy here and there. Like, the more time we spent with Jason and Marie, the happier I was. And especially, I mean, we get into, is that her brothers? Is that her exes? I forget where we end up in that house.
Her exes, I think, probably. Her ex. Felt like.
Yeah, there was definitely some awkwardness. But seeing them get there and then the way that whole section unfolds is really lovely, because you do get a sense of, we don't know what these people are going to do, and now we have kids involved, and they're the most cutest kids in the world, right? Like,
yeah,
I have to pee.
Yeah.
And there's some relationship dynamics that are happening. And then, you know, when Jason suddenly realizes something's not right, get underground, all that goes away. It's like, once again, his cover's blown, so to speak. We don't even know what his cover really is. But now we just know that danger is here, and we don't want it to be here. What I don't like about that scene, and this might be a writing thing, I don't know why the sniper guy goes into the field. Like, he gives up his position and goes into this field where he's now vulnerable. Like, he had the vantage point. And so that doesn't really make sense to me. But what I do really like about it, other than it's Clive Owen, which is crazy to see him in this kind of weird throwaway role. But what I really love about it is whenever he gets hit with that shotgun, I love the effect there. Like, the performance is great. He spins and there's all this, the fluff from the jacket kind of spits out. It's just a beautiful little sequence that makes me feel like, oh, that hurt, and well done. Like, you get a good sense of the cat and mouse that's being played there. But largely, I mean, I don't know. Look,
I agree.
That's that sequence we played about, you know, Jason knowing all the exits and license. I would be the worst spy in the world. I wouldn't see any of that.
You can't even recognize faces. If I shave, you won't know who I am. You freaking kidding me?
And he would be like, yeah, I know where every exit. And I was like, there's exits here? Like,
yeah. We can leave?
We can go? Terrible spy.
Yeah.
I don't know why a sniper would go into the field. Maybe there's a really good, smart reason about that, but I do love that cat and mouse element. I love him having that conversation, putting Matt Damon and Clive Owen together in that kind of scene. Perfect. Yeah. Because I buy into, like, Jason's really trying to get some information, and this guy is just, like, done with it all. And he's having this final seconds of someone who might be able to understand him, and he's just in his own little world. Like, it all kind of plays really well together, I think, because of the performances. Not necessarily because of the writing, which is solid. Tony Gilroy, he's one of the best screenwriters, as time and time again he keeps proving. And yeah, I don't know. So I say all that, you know, and I think I mostly really, really like this film. I don't know that if it's necessarily because of the era and my nostalgia, or if someone were to watch this today and they would get the same level of engagement. But I think a lot of it has to do with what you said too, like watching Jason wrestle and just piece by piece figure out, go through this trail, and then the whole question of this movie is, who is this guy? And you don't really find that out. The one thing you find out at the end is that he was in some kind of program and that he's a part of the government, he's a government agent, and the fact that he walks away from that's really satisfying. But I like that there's not a lot of information we really get out of it. And that's enough for him. He doesn't need to know more. He's like, if that's all this is, then fine. Just leave me alone. I'm trying to walk away. That's a crazy arc to just go through this whole thing. He's not really that much wiser from it, but he gets just enough information to know, I don't want to be a part of that. I'm leaving whatever that is behind, and I'm okay with that. That's kind of satisfying in and of itself. I think today we might push it too much. That might be like the halfway point, right? And you try to push that a little bit further of, well, what else can he know? And how, can he take down the whole program? That was never really his goal. He didn't know about a program. He didn't even know what Treadstone was. He thought it was a person at one point. He's like,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. What did you make about that whole plot line being resolved with, okay, I'm good and I'm walking away now?
I mean, yeah, sure. He doesn't want to be that guy anymore. He even said it. It's not me. That guy is dead. And if I even, you know, he said that to, what's his name? He said, if I even think that you're behind me, I'm going to come after you full force. He doesn't want to be an assassin. When he found that out, it was like really traumatic for him, for her too, obviously, because she didn't know who he was, but for him, that's not who he is. And, you know, we don't really fully know that as viewers, I guess, until, well, first off, when we see the flashback of him not killing, assassinating the guy because of the kids, but then especially when he gets a chance to save the family, to save the kids, in the scene at the ranch, which, by the way, I want to say that I love that scene. I agree with you. I don't like the field scene, but I do, because that doesn't make any sense to me. I was watching it thinking, like, where's this field coming from? Why are they not staying in the trees? Like, that makes sense. But just being an onlooker, well, first off, they didn't use the whole use night to block anything. Mm. You know, we're in the middle of the morning daylight, right? So you cannot hide, right? So I thought that was like really, really aggressive. Like, that was really awesome that they did that. Cause
pretty fresh.
I think now, yeah. So nowadays they would have done it at night, you know, and all that stuff. So that was cool. Also, his just immediate calm reaction made me feel safe.
Hmm.
Like I was one of those children, you know, like, he's like, don't worry, it's not going to happen. You know, like, she's worried about the kids. It'll be fine. Or what? I don't know what he says, but when he said it, and this is the acting of Matt Damon, who honestly is like one of my favorite actors. Like, the guy is just so good at everything he does. I always believe it. I've never seen a movie with Matt Damon in it where I'm disappointed ever. Mm. I mean, maybe the movie sucked.
Right. Not him.
You know, when he says that, when he says that's not going to happen, I 100% believe him. And I'm like, okay, well, how is he going to do it? And that becomes the interesting thing, how he does it, not whether or not he will. Hmm. And in a movie where it's like, you know, super suspenseful, sometimes that's fun and okay. So anyway, really, I forgot what I was saying. What were we talking about?
No idea. but you're right in terms of the doing it in the daytime is really cool. And I think that's one of the things I really loved about the lighting of this film. Is that they're constantly doing this broad general lighting, what I would think is 360 lighting. And 360 lighting just being a term that says you can basically point the camera anywhere and you're not going to get your lights into the shot. And so it allows a lot of freedom, you know, like the actors can move around, the cam op can move around almost anywhere. Oftentimes, if it is actual 360 lighting, then you really can, you know, move anywhere. But even at worst, okay, maybe you can't necessarily move anywhere, but it only takes them, you know, a couple of minutes to flag a light or to turn one off so that you can get the lighting that you want. And so it's very fast paced a shooting environment, which is, to me, very satisfying for an actor to be able to constantly stay in the headspace and to stay connected to your blocking so that whenever you're ready to do your next take, it hasn't been 45 minutes, you know, setting up a dolly. So between takes, you know, that's insanity. And so this kind of lighting is more fun. And I like the look. It's not always super soft and it's feels very lived in. It feels very organic to the environments. Same thing with the cab at night. Like, there's whenever I forget where they're going. I think they're looking for a new location. And you have a choice. Like, how do you light the interior of a back seat? That's always going to be a hard decision. At night, where's that light coming from? Do you light it through the city? Right. And then you maybe motivate a little light on the outside of the car. Or do you motivate the light interior, right? A phone or the dashboard. Is the dashboard, you know, motivating the light to the back seat? It's a bit of a stress, a strain. And so the way they did it was the dome light. They made it feel like there's a dome light on the inside. There probably wasn't. I would imagine they probably had like a stunt car where you either remove the roof or you have a hole in the roof. Or, you know, you're creating some kind of lighting scenario that allows you to not have a driver, and you now can push a light just up there, flag a little bit. And like, that's always a choice, but it just allows for so much more movement for the actor. I love the lighting in here. And yeah. even the way they grade it, which I wonder if this was an actual color grade or it was more of just washes. But the shadows in throughout the film are nearly crushed. Like, they're not completely, you know, crushed in into the black, but you do keep the faintest detail just on the toe of the curve. You know, it's barely there, but enough to give you a sense of there's something happening in the shadows. I think it's beautiful, and it plays into the style of the film perfectly. A lot of wide angles. Like, man, I really enjoy this film, you know, just from the cinematography aspect because of how much it contrasts with what everyone's doing today. Everyone's doing these big soft boxes just out of frame and everything's super soft, and it's very boring and tedious to me. And it's this kind of stuff that I really don't want to do anymore. Whenever I get to watch something like this, though, I'm like, yeah, you know what? This feels real, and it feels like we're watching someone in an office. And this is the way office lighting kind of looks. And it's not 100% the way offices look, but it's close enough that you don't feel like it's a movie set. That, to me, is really cool. And the great use of... I'm not a fan of, like, gimbal work, but here they do a great use of, like, Steadicam mixed with handheld so that whenever you move to handheld, it doesn't feel completely divorced from what you were doing before, because the Steadicam also kind of has this not wobble to it, but it's uneven and it just kind of swims a little bit here and there. And that's just enough so that whenever you suddenly move into handheld, which when he gets to fighting, man, we are all about it. And it mixes really, really nice. I enjoy it. Like when we're on the ship at the beginning, they're not handheld, but they're going, I want to say it's probably Steadicam. And they're doing a lot of nice swimming, and you're just kind of imitating the current, right, of the underneath the boat. And it fits, even if some of that stuff is just at dock. Like, the camera work alone makes you feel like you're at sea, so that whenever you do those wide shots at sea, it all intercuts really lovely. Like, I think they just did such a terrific job. Oliver Wood, who, you know, is not a name on the tip of my tongue, but I'm curious to see some of his other work. And especially because Doug Liman, this is his second film after Swingers. He did Swingers, and then he did Go. And Go is basically Swingers Part 2 in terms of style. It's not this. So it kind of blows my mind that Doug Liman went from doing those kind of films to Bourne Identity, which then gave him carte blanche. Like, he made Bourne Identity, suddenly, what do you want next? And I think it's him probably partnering with Oliver Wood that said, okay, let's tell a spy thriller in my way. And so it's them kind of compromising their styles that gave a lot of interesting texture to this film that you just weren't going to see in, whatever, Mission Impossible. Like, Brian De Palma doing that first Mission Impossible, which we should do at some point.
We should. I was just going to say that.
Yeah. Right? Like, those are highly polished. When we go Dutch, we go Dutch. And it's just very locked in. This feels very wishy-washy. Like, we're going to shoot over here. Let's shoot over here, and we'll figure it out later. Like, we'll fix it in post. Was probably, like, on placards around the office. And it works. You know what? Like, they knew what they were getting on the day, and they knew that, you know, the style was going to be frenetic at points. And so as long as we know what we're seeing in the frame, it'll cut. Just make sure we know what we're seeing in frame, and how that'll board around it. Otherwise, don't get too precious. And it works for me, man. I really enjoy it. Yeah. So I want to jump just real quick into some of the story and writing, because this is the last bit I got. There's like three big plot lines that are happening, right? You have Jason and Marie, you have Wambosi, which is somewhat of a subplot, and then the CIA. And intercutting with the CIA is really nice because it allows us to jump in time and allow Jason and Marie to travel. There's only so much we want to sit with them in a car. And before you feel like, did they really get to Paris just now from Switzerland or wherever? Like, you need to cut away to give them time to advance. Doing that also allows us to get an idea about the reality of who Bourne is. So we're getting hints, but we're not getting enough information. We know they're after him, but we don't know why. And so this is helping us piece together a little bit of Jason as he's piecing together a little bit of stuff without giving us so much information that it becomes boring. We still have questions that we need answered. Okay, but they want him, but why? Oh, now they're setting him up. They're killing Wambosi and then blaming it on Boren. But why? And you just slowly piece together there's miraculously, I can't believe there's some, the U.S. would have a program like this, that kind of thing. Of course, it's completely in keeping with foreign policy. But then also there's this really nice segue that allows us to fill in that Jason's in danger, which is that whole sequence of activate them all. And then we have this montage of agents being contacted and prepping to put Boren in a body bag by sundown. So now we're anticipating an attack so that whenever this guy randomly comes through a window, it's not random. Without all that stuff with the CIA, we don't know why. It feels really weird for a guy to just burst in with a machine gun shooting through a window. But once you start anticipating like, oh, there's people, agents coming up online, you begin to just, you're waiting for it now. And then when it happens, it's like, okay, finally, you know, I can breathe and the tension kind of goes away. And they do a great job with tension. Like the other, I think maybe the most tense I get in this whole film, other than that guy pulling a pin out of his knuckles, which is so gruesome and beautiful. Ugh. Like what a great, like a moment to really pull the audience in, because anything in Jason's hands is a weapon. But the other, the most tense I probably get is him on that rickety, rusted out fire escape and then climbing down. Like, that's a beautiful little sequence. And I, every time I watch that, I get like, what is it? The vertigo. And I'm like, oh God, don't slip. That thing is not going to hold you. Like, great job. All of it. The editing, the sound design, the acting, all of it just perfectly plays. And it's slow. They take their time. They don't rush it. God, I think that's just a beautiful sequence, soup to nuts. And then the other thing that I really appreciated, and I've mentioned it half a dozen times at least, which is the rule of repeats. Tell us the plan, then subvert the plan. There's only two ways to do this. If you tell us what's going to happen, that can't be what actually happens. Or you cannot tell us what's going to happen and then surprise us. Either way, you need to surprise us. And here, the way they use it is Hotel Regina. He's going to have a Marie go in and count her steps and mark out all the exits and tell us who's all in there. And then call him, you know, with, he's going to call her and he's going to walk her through how to get what he wants. It's all this big complex details and he's getting freaked out and it's kind of raising the tension a little bit with what's happened. And then she's tapping on the glass. She's like, yeah, I just asked for it. And it's a great way to subvert her expectations by making that something feel that like it's going to be really convoluted. And you know what? It was easy. I'm cute. And so I use that. Oh yeah. Good thinking. And it's a beautiful use of just raising our expectations and subverting it with something, you know, simple and clean cut. Yeah. Yeah, man. It's a really fun ride. I like how it ends on the beach with her running a restaurant / scooter store. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember when I was watching it, I was thinking, because I don't remember seeing this, which is crazy. I mean, it's 22 years ago, so right. I don't blame myself, but I just don't, there was a lot of it that felt very new. Like, I was like, I don't remember this scene. I don't remember this scene. And so when it got towards the end, because I know there are multiple, I was thinking, how do they, they got to tie this up somehow. They didn't know they were going to make 2 and 3 or whatever. So they got to tie it up somehow. How are they going to tie this up? Huh? Interesting. So I expected them to tie it up because I don't think that they knew they were going to do, you know, sequels. And so I was just wondering, and I felt like that was perfect. You know, imagine if this was its own, you know, it lives as its own film. There's not a sequel. There's not a, you know, whatever. It just is what it is. That's exactly what I want for Jason, is that to live in Mallorca or wherever the hell they are, selling scooters with her. You know, finding her. And I love that he said that you're a little hard to find. He's like, nice store. It's hard to find. But after everything after as badass as we know that he is, she's hard to find. Shows how badass she is too.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was great. And then we hear that music at the end, that timeless, you know, Jason Bourne music, which I don't know. Is it Moby? It sounds very Moby. Like, and especially Moby, right? In 2002, that'd probably be Moby, you know? I would not be surprised if Moby wrote that, that piece of music. But yeah, no, absolutely. I don't know. I love this movie. I really do. I feel like it's a staple for anybody who wants to get into either spy films or anything like that. And it's based off of not a true story, but like a guy, an actual occurrence of a guy who got amnesia. He just woke up one day, like didn't have like a piece of trauma. He just woke up one day and didn't remember his life. Whoa. And didn't know where he was. And he started a whole nother life. And then he like opened a corner store or something. And like 3 months into owning this corner store, just happened to remember his old life. Yeah. He's like, and he was like, how the hell did I get here? Yeah. So, and that's what the story kind of like started as. And then, you know, I'm sure they thought, well, you know, let's make it more interesting and make him an assassin
who
didn't remember that he was an assassin. You know, how cool of a story is that, really? You know? So anyway, I just love it. Matt Damon is irreplaceable. He's a national treasure to me. I thought the story was really well written. Yes, there were some things where, you know, looking back at it 22 years later, like if they just did a pass, like you said, you made a good suggestion. If you just did a remastering of this film, right, where you went in and replaced some of the shitty sound design, I think that it would be fantastic. I love the vibe. Like you called out the color. Love the grading on this film. It's obvious they shot on film.
Yeah.
Anytime you watch a movie shot on film, it just feels different. It's the same thing as listening to music that's on vinyl instead of like on Spotify. It just has a warmth and like color to it that you can't, you know, even with like plugins and stuff, I just really don't think is the same, you know?
And it's not the same, especially for this era, because you punted less to post. Like now, I think they preserve a lot of detail in order to decide what their look is really going to be in post afterwards. Whereas here, they had to go in with a game plan of what do we want this to look like? Because a lot of it's going to be baked in. And once your look is baked in, that means there's really no going back. And so you come in with a game plan of here's the textures we really want. Here's the kind of contrast that we want. You know, we're going to make sure that the color palette is very clearly declared. And that's why a lot of the filmmakers that are big now are still doing those things. Wes Anderson is still deciding what his color palette is very, very strongly beforehand. Now, I'm not saying no filmmakers are, you know, just because you're not a big filmmaker, you're not thinking about those things. But I think there is less emphasis on deciding a lot of these things, like how contrasty you want it. And these films, man, it's all about making those decisions and figuring that out way before. I mean, you spend so much time in pre-production debating and deciding and testing looks, and I don't think people are doing that as much, especially with studio involvement, how much stuff is being done by streamers. They come in and they're like, you know, we don't want you to make too many decisions. What do you want to do? Cool. Just make sure we can undo any of that once we get in the post.
Yeah.
And otherwise, go have fun. It's like, well, you're kind of chopping out my legs. And so that's why I think part of the reason why so much stuff looks the same is because no one's really making those decisions and just going for it during production. Instead, they're kind of making some of those decisions. We think we want it to be this, but we'll figure it out later. And it's just not as rewarding. It's just not as strong of a look. Yeah, that's my two cents anyway. No one dropped a nickel in my jukebox, Todd. Nice. So what are you going to recommend this week?
Oh, this week I'm going to recommend... It's kind of out of my normal wheelhouse. I normally recommend like you know, more modern films. But this movie, I think, totally changed the way that I looked at cinematography, like more so than his other films. I'm going to recommend North by Northwest.
Whoa.
Yeah, from 1959. It's old school.
Cary
not
Grant.
Because
well
the
done.
Acting is great, not because the writing is even great, but the way that they set up shots in this movie, and you remember it's 1959, blows my mind. It's so freaking good. And they're little things. Like, there's a scene where he and this woman are talking on the train, and it's just back and forth of them talking. Well, the train comes to a stop, and it switches back to him, and it's the same shot as before, but we can still see out the window, and we see the cops coming toward the train that's stopped out the window. But it's the same. So we get story from a shot that we've had for 5 straight minutes that all of a sudden has a new element that's tied to it that wasn't there before. That is unbelievable detail from 70 years ago that we don't have now. And it's dramatic detail just through the camera position that doesn't change. It's so cool. It's just really so cool. So I would recommend to anybody to go watch this movie just from a cinematic, you know, cinematography perspective. You'll see so many movies now, like hearkening back to a film like this. and you'll understand why Hitchcock is what he is.
Yeah.
And why he was so militant on set and wanted what he had in his head. He saw the vision and he God damn it, he's going to get it. And he got it. And I feel like almost every shot in here feels thought out and placed perfectly. It's so good. So yeah, North by Northwest.
Well done, man. Damn. I'm going to recommend. So I a couple weeks ago, I'm sure, I recommended PBS Frontline. And I finally just watched their Academy Award winning. I didn't realize they were up for an award, but they, 20 Days in Mariupol, about the invasion in Ukraine. And it's,
oh, I've yeah. Oh, okay.
Brutal. I mean, I probably only really watched, like, looked on maybe like 35-40% of it. Instead, I kind of watched it out of the corner of my eye, listened, because it's in part English and in part, I don't know what that language would be, Ukrainian or Russian. And listening to it was enough, but I think it's important to watch some of that stuff, just to know what's happening in the world, and to be confronted with, you know, all of that. Like, some of it's graphics. There's not a lot of good things happening here. And a lot of kids die, a lot of innocent people die. And it's good to wrestle with that stuff. Yeah. So I'll leave it there. God. So good. Incredible. I'm so glad they won. I don't know how many times they've won best documentary, but I was really glad, because as I was, you know, just going on about a couple weeks ago when I mentioned them, like, they're just doing incredible work, and it's really nice that they're being rewarded for that. I wonder how many other times they've won. Yeah. And stay tuned for next week. We're going to take another recent film, not another being in comparison to 20 Days, not in comparison to The Bourne Identity. And we're going to take a look at Past Lives. I think it's a nice break from The Bourne Identity. And I really want to do more recent films. There's just not a ton of recent films that I think overlap well with what we try to do here. But I think Past Lives is probably one of them. Todd hasn't seen it yet, and so I'm excited to see what he thinks, if he's just like, thumbs down, yawn, or if he, I don't know, connects with it. TBD, but stay tuned for that next week. If you're enjoying the show, subscribe, drop us a review. And if you want to leave a note on this episode, you can do that at thepestlepodcast.com/TheBourneIdentity.
What?
That's the music.
Oh, yeah, this is the music. All right. And our quote of the day is from Edward Snowden, of course. Of course. I think this is great. There can be no faith in government if our highest offices are excused from scrutiny. They should be setting the example of transparency. Could not agree more, man. So, so freaking good. God.
I think that's the thing that I really love about The Bourne Identity as compared to Mission Impossible. Like, I know Ethan Hunt's whole thing is about, like, him being rogue or whatever. But the thing with The Bourne Identity is how he's not rogue. He is actively trying to say no to what the government is trying to get him to do. And I appreciate that perspective of the good guys aren't always the ones who are official. Like, just because there's a law doesn't make it moral, and just because your government's doing something doesn't make it right. And so from that perspective, I really appreciate that. And the Bourne Identity, right, they're doing a whole program that's undercover, even from our own representatives. And I don't think that's very outrageous. Now, what they're doing is a little outlandish, of course, programming agents. Not that the government hasn't tried to do that stuff before, but that they're successfully doing, that's all, of course, crazy town. But the idea that there's subversion within the intelligence, you know, apparatus is not crazy. And, you know, I don't think it's an accident that our government, our officials let people get away with that. And wink and nod like, Brian Cox's character, right? Abbott is like, no, I'm asking now. I know I'm not supposed to be asking. And that's their whole wink and nod relationship between Conklin and Abbott. And now he's like, no, I'm asking now. Like, I don't know. I love Edward Snowden. I love this perspective of, you want us to have faith in you. You need to be completely transparent and not above scrutiny, which is just so upside down from the reality. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I just word salad all that.
Awesome. Well, I had a great time. I love this movie. Nice. I think it's a staple. Everybody should see it.
Yeah.
I had a great time talking to you about it, and exactly. Hopefully you guys have had a good time listening, and maybe you agree, maybe you don't. Love to hear it in the comments. Please subscribe, review us wherever you can, share us with your friends. It all helps. It makes a difference for us, and we love hearing from you. If there's a film that you'd like to see us pull apart and talk about, make a suggestion. Who knows? Maybe we'll do it. Until next time, I'm Todd.
I'm Wes.
Go watch some movies.